That would occur is if the signals that come from the brain are able to be, in effect, received and amplified and transmitted. Would that be fairly close to what's done?
Well, in the original, when the Czechs, who coined the term psychotronics, tried to sell the Soviets, their Soviet patrons on this idea, that is, they tried to sell them actually a bill of goods. That's how this whole program got started in the late 60s. The Czechs attempted to convince the Soviets that they could do that. And in fact, they never could, nor has it been done to date. What can be done, however, is by the pure use of electronics, you can affect the human nervous system, and you can do certain things with the human brain, waves. And if you'd like me to get into that kind of technology, I can talk about it.
All right. Well, when you say affect brain waves, do you mean general patterns of thinking, or you can induce a specific idea into a brain that would not otherwise think of it itself?
Hypothetically, both.
God, that's frightening. So heads of state, Bill Clinton, tentatively Boris Yeltsin. By the way, have you looked at what's going to occur in Russia at all? The elections are coming up Sunday. Any idea what's going to happen?
No. We pretty much shy away from political things like that. We stick as much as we can with science and technology targets, although we did help the FBI look for the other Unabomber. There's someone else that got mixed in with mailing things that got mixed and matched in with...
Yes, I heard you were involved in that.
Yeah, there's... We just want to make sure they get both of them.
So there's somebody else out there still?
Yes, there's somebody else that... Kaczynski was not responsible for all those packages in the mail. There were a couple of other culprits, and those are the ones that we tracked for the Bureau. They'll be rolled up eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of something that is not science and technology oriented, but here we felt the need to assist my erstwhile colleagues.
Now, while you say that your targets are non-political, my guess would be that even if they were political, you would tell me that.
I'm not sure I follow you.
Well, in other words, I asked you, do you ever work on things like Boris Yeltsin, the election in Russia, and so forth? And you said, no, we concentrate mainly on non-political targets.
That's correct.
But what I'm saying is, even if the reality were that you did occasionally concentrate on political targets, you would tell me that you didn't.
That's negative. I would never lie to you.
Really?
I would never lie to the American public. If I could not tell you for reasons, then I would say...
You would just say, I can't talk about it.
But I would not lie to you.
All right. Good enough. I appreciate that. It's just that's such, you know, I would imagine our own politicians listening to this would potentially be frightened out of their socks.
It was extremely frightening to members of Congress that were briefed on the existence of our program, specifically
exactly.
The heads of the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees. They were frightened to death because in an ideal world where there were no secrets, politicians have a very difficult time surviving in that world. They were the ones that were the most frightened of all.
Yeah, they have a tough enough time as it is. So if Bob Dole's campaign people came to SciTech and said, look, we're in trouble with this campaign. We've got this guy Clinton. We need to know what's going on. And they laid cash on the table at SciTech. Now, I know you've done work, for example, looking at Japanese car companies for American car companies.
Actually, that was serendipitous. We were approached by a very large automobile company that wanted to help us. They wanted us to help them research hydrogen power plants and to take a look at some of their potential designs to see if they were dead-end research pathways. In so doing, when you go into this library in the sky, if you will, what we call the matrix, the collective unconscious, we pulled out designs that were Japanese and German. And so it was serendipitous. It was not intentional. That's called, corporate espionage, or the more polite term these days is business research.
Business research. So SciTech does that.
No, we absolutely do not.
Oh,
in the early days, we did work for corporations like that, but that was 1990-91. We no longer do that, strictly science and technology.
You think it's unethical?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although I'm asked constantly by my students, you know, what would happen if you trained someone and they went off and did that? And I said, well, you know, I'm not responsible for what students do with this technology once they take it away.
In other words, you're like a gun manufacturer.
Some people have described that, described me as that, but I have to mention that if, you know, the same people, if you have two opposing sides that are both technical remote viewers, they're looking at each other. there are no secrets.
Well, you've had a lot of students. Do you, without naming any, because I wouldn't want you to, are any of them out there doing this kind of work?
Yes, they're out there doing the work. I've just trained a team of about 10 Germans, extremely good remote viewers, and they're putting together their own team.
Suppose, again, I was on the Bob Dole campaign, and I came in, laid cash on the table, and said, all right, I understand you can't do it. Give me some names.
I would never give you the names of my students. Unless the students volunteered their names.
Interesting. Knowing that this works, and we've given the public a lot of examples.
Now, let me qualify this. I have students who would talk to you on the air, but they would give you their names, but I would not volunteer them up.
Even with a little pile of cash from the Dole campaign?
Absolutely not.
All right. Boy, you're in a real minefield of ethical dilemma with this business. Now it is a business.
It's the only business of its kind in the world. We have a monopoly on accuracy, and we're not an institute, a center, or foundation. We have to deliver, and so
we're the first
in the world to guarantee 100%.
I was about to say that. You did and do guarantee 100% accuracy?
That's correct, but on the reports that we deliver to clients, 100% accuracy. The way we do that is to take trained remote viewers who are rigorously trained, and we run controls, double-check our work, and we run controls. And when independently worked targets, the mutually corroborating data worked from independent viewers, is the overlap of data is what we guarantee to be 100% correct.
How many of you at SciTech are resident viewers? I guess that'd be a way to put it, huh?
7, and we have access to about 25 more who are part-time.
So if you've got a really big job, a really big contract, how do you decide what jobs to take on and what jobs to refuse? And roughly what percentage of jobs do you refuse versus those you take on?
In the last 2 years, I have been approached by a number of captains of industry who wanted us to work various things. And what I've been doing is suggesting that rather than hire SciTech to solve a problem, that they send their chief engineers, key scientists, not CEOs, because CEOs don't have the time to go back and apply this. We train the engineers and scientists from corporations and send them back 2 at a time so that we work their problem in the classroom after about day 6 or 7 of training. It's a 9-day course. It's actually 10 days with a 1-day break. Students need it mid-course. We solve the problem if it's a simple problem, for instance, looking for design flaws or other things, in the classroom, and send back to the corporation 2 trained doers so they have in-house assets and don't have to necessarily rely upon SciTech to solve problems in the future unless it's complex. The only contracts we would accept these days are ones that are important to us, for instance, cures for AIDS or where the Ebola virus hides when it's late and those kinds of things.
You've got your own agenda.
Yes, I do.
Major, after I did the first program with you, I decided to try a little experiment, and I brought an item in here, and I've never done this kind of thing before. I brought an item in, set it on my ham rig, and sat and stared at it and stared at it and concentrated on it and invited the audience to try and figure out what I was staring at. And I've never felt so invaded in my entire life. You could feel eyes, and my wife could too, all over this house. And, that's not really evidence, but let me finish. Then people were sending me faxes of what this item was. And 2 people, Major, hit this item flat on the head. One of them so much so it scared the hell out of me. Let me tell you what it was. It was a little marble plaque with my photograph on it that had been laser, put on there by a laser in marble with a little metal stand, and somebody sent me a fax showing this with a little metal stand with the exact curves, and that's where I said, I think I've had enough. I've never seen anything like this in my life. It is absolutely impossible that out of the 100 or 200 replies I've had, 2 people hit this dead on the nose. There's no way in hell they could have done it if they'd not been here.
Well, there's 2 dynamics at work there. One is telepathy. That's what was used to be called beaconing in the laboratory. If you are staring at an item and asking someone to read your thoughts, that's telepathy. They're telepathically picking up on what you're looking at. But the way we work is not telepathy. we actually go to where you are resident as a pattern of information, hypothetically, in what we call the matrix, the collective unconscious, and where that specific item is. That item becomes our target, and I can teach children how to do this. This is a very, very simple operation, and there's an interesting science project that I teach fifth graders. And they do just this kind of thing where the teacher tags an item in her home, mm-hmm. goes and tells the student that it's tagged, doesn't tell the student what it is. Five girls and boys end up sketching the item. It's very non-trusting to the science project boards, but...
Well, Major, I'm a believer. We're going to break here for news at the top of the hour. You've got a little bit of time. Relax. Get a cup of coffee, something. We'll be right back to you.
Thank you.
From SciTech, Major Ed Dames is my guest. We'll be right back. The last hour, establishing... what remote viewing was, what it is today, what it has done, what the Major has done. This hour, we're going to talk about some things the Major knows. And I think a good place to begin is I got a piece of email from the Major. I can't recall when it was. Some weeks ago, actually. I got something. I have something called Arts Parts. That were sent to me, ostensibly pieces of the crashed Roswell saucer. And we've been putting them through a rigorous scientific testing. As a matter of fact, the results, very anomalous results of that testing, are available to be seen on my webpage now. And it's remarkable material, bismuth and magnesium layered in a way that has a lot of people jumping. I don't want to get too far out of the game right now. And some of the aluminum parts and the spectrography and the scanning microscope pictures are all up on the Internet. It's www.artbell.com. www.artbell.com. And I suspect, if not already, and I know Keith, so he's probably got a link to the Major's webpage already as well up there. So you'd be well to visit my webpage and take a look. The complete scientific report is there. But I got a piece of email from the Major not long ago, a couple weeks, 3 weeks ago. And you just mentioned in an offhand way, Major, that you had your team for practice or for fun or for whatever reason working on my Roswell parts.
Yes, we actually do that. My trainees, I train 20 people a year in this in between contract work that we do. And I used your metallic object, metallic pieces, as training targets.
Well, I want to know.
I have some preliminary results, but it will cost you one of those Art Bell watches. How's that for effort?
It can easily be arranged.
Only kidding. Actually, let me tell you what I assumed that we were dealing with. When my students are trained, they are not told what their targets are. They're trained in the blind. Their unconscious is trained to do the work. It's similar to flying a plane at night. You have to rely on your instruments, and you really can't. If you do not know how to read those instruments, the analogy here is if you do not understand the structure of remote viewing, you're going to slip off the target.
Mm-hmm.
Trainees are not allowed to graduate until they can get it right every single time. So, as advanced training targets, day 6 or 7, I slipped a few trainees' arts parts.
Mm-hmm.
When we do this, I've never seen those parts on your webpage. So I actually called them that, and pieces, metallic pieces, and I called them in italics, arts parts. The collective unconscious can do the rest. We know that it can. Some interesting results. I assumed as a former project officer for very secret projects, both aerospace and metallurgical, that we were probably dealing with scrap parts.
Right.
Scrap electronic parts or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
As a project manager, I had many scientists working for me. University professors and industrialists, and they would be making things that I needed on the battlefield in space or somewhere else. And I'd bring pieces of those back to my office. All of us who were in positions similar to I had things like this, gewgaws and doodads on our office. Sometimes we'd even bring them home, unless they were radioactive. And many times these projects failed if a corporation, say the Alcoa Corporation, had a classified contract with the government to build something, to make some new sheet metal. And that didn't work out right because it was penetrated by a tungsten bullet or something like that. Then
right.
This metal became scrap. I felt that that's what you were dealing with. Another case, something that's interesting to point out, the Russians, the former Soviets, their metallurgy was sometimes far superior to U.S. metallurgy.
Right.
Don't forget, they were making titanium submarines, behemoths, that we could not produce.
Hmm.
So keep that in mind as we talk about this. I did. as the results started to come in, and these are initial results. But I do want to talk about them.
All right.
Okay. The parts are actually they're land-based, earth-based. They're not alien.
Okay.
And but their story is very interesting, and I think I'll illustrate it with a story. Let's call the story hypothetical for the moment.
Okay.
A certain scientist, who I might know, is approached one day with some pieces similar to Art's parts, and he is asked, "How have you gotten a hold of alien technology?" And the scientist says, "Well, I don't have alien technology." "Well, we are looking at your blueprints for a specific thing that you submitted to the patent office, a specific set of parts. And this happens to be the same thing that crashed in the desert about 1950, alien spacecraft." And the scientist says, "Well, no, I designed this myself." "Well, Art's parts are about 16 years young. This is from a prototype vehicle that slipped back in time. Art's parts are from a time machine."
Really?
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah. It's about 11 or 12 years out there. In fact, we can even become aware of the actual scientists that are working on that today. How's that for a paradox problem? This is a series of vehicles that the military team that I ran started to perceive about 1984-85. We started to gain information on these things that essentially, let me put this, make sure that this picture is set in your listeners' minds. A group of scientists about 10 years from now, perhaps less, happen to test a prototype design, which is spinning, and this is very important. I'll get back to this in a moment, of the, some of the physics of how this happens. This device, instead of going up and out into space, disappears. And it flies about 200 miles from its test point in the southwest desert and crashes about 50 years earlier in the desert. Now, the people that find this about 1950, the individuals that find it, cordon off the area. And this was not a Roswell crash, by the way. Roswell was alien. This was not. I'll get to that some other time. They find this, these pieces. And they automatically assume, because it's probably four generations of technology ahead of anything they had in 1950s, that it's alien. Must
sure.
be, right? Metallurgy
automatically,
it is.
Sure.
So they hold on to it until one day somebody notices that a design that a certain scientist is submitting to the patent office matches this. So it must be alien, right? The metallurgical processes that you see in front of you and on the screen are really not that far from what we can do now. If we really wanted to put the money into it, we could produce the kinds of pressures that would be necessary to produce the kind of density and those kinds of alloys. It could be done, and I'm sure technicians have said as much, but they're not here yet. It slipped back.
Well, this this bismuth piece of the supposed skin of the craft, whatever kind of craft it is, while it could be done, I don't think it has been done. We've had people checking very carefully. Nobody's done it. They don't know what it could be. Some sort of a superconductor or a collector of energy on the skin of a craft of some kind. So what you say could be.
It's about another generation out there of technology. And it just slipped back. But I want to illustrate how this first event occurred. In phenomenology, there's an occasional report of when a tornado passes by a certain place, that later people find pieces of straw and sometimes wood right through a glass window. The
That's
window
right.
supposedly fused around the straw.
That's right.
Just so happens that the vortex that's created by tornadoes, when the tornado turns a specific way at a certain angle, depending on where it is, does something with time. Bends or shifts time, slows it down as the earth is turning. And the earth turns into this place where two things begin to share the same space. Then the tornado moves away, and now they do share the same space. This spinning, this vortex, and the angle of the vortex is very important to this discovery. Time travel, of course, as we know it now, as most physicists would state, would require an energy equivalent to a black hole to affect. Could
right.
be done, but you need that. It's not within our tech base to do it. And yet, it does seem to be a little trick that nature plays at certain times. And one of these prototype devices fell into that trick and slipped back.
Wow. And that's where my parts came from.
It would appear that your parts fit a class of objects that we in my company know to be those things, yes.
Phew.
Time travel, by the way, is quite a real thing out there in the cosmos as far as we're concerned. Having had 15 years of experience looking at things for NASA and NORAD that they don't talk about. Vehicles, races that use time travel and teleportation, they need time standards, as you know. If you're traveling along a gravity wave or along a gravity surface and you pop in somewhere, you need to know not only where you are, but what time it is. And so pulsars and things similar to pulsars are used as a galactic time standard, if you will, to know when you are rather than just where you are, in addition to where you are. Crop circles, for instance, are specifically used for on-the-ground registration marks. The crop circles that we talk about, they're so enigmatic to most people. For us in SciTech, we know what they are. They're purposely put in perishable media, ephemeral media, to last only one day, so that you know on the ground, right there in a local environment, a tactical environment, if you will, what day it is.
Huh.
So that when you transit time again and you see that specific crop circle that's in a registration book of some type, you know what day you are in.
All right.
Because you know that in that book, on that specific day, some registration vehicle made that it's tagged, doesn't tell the student what it is. Five girls and boys end up sketching the item. It's very non-trusting to the science project boards, but... We will make that SciTech contract available to the public via our Transition 3000 website in the future.
All right. Let us understand then, remote viewing does time travel of its own in a sense.
It doesn't. Time drops out of the equation. Mind is outside of time. There is no time in the collective unconscious. If I look at Art Bell's life as a remote viewer, a technical remote viewer, I see you from birth to death and points in between. There is no time there. You are a gestalt of information, a pattern of information resonant in this collective unconscious. That's not to say you don't have a soul or personality. Of course you do.
Sure.
But in terms of information, this is an information collection technology, and there is no time involved. We look left to see the past or right to see the future, metaphorically speaking, and we just download information.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know about the past. Everybody's very curious about the future, and... The last time I had you on, you scared the hell out of me and everybody else as you look to the right. And now I want to underscore this. We're going to sort of repeat, I'm sure, what you said last time. But I want to underscore it by saying that about, I think it was 2 or 3 days ago, ABC on the Evening News, Major, had a most remarkable story about the Plain States, our farm belt. And that story basically said, scientists have now determined that they were wrong. Or may have been wrong, that our climate is much more tenuous, much more fragile than we ever thought it was. They went way beyond that. They said there is a significant possibility, they now believe, that we may be headed toward what they called another dust bowl, or even went beyond that, and said they can see our plain states, our farm states, becoming deserts. Not only that, but that process is actually underway right now. And that's a frightening possibility. And the moment I saw it, I almost fell off my couch, and I got a lot of other faxes of the same sort, hearkening back to what you said, what you see coming. Now, about 10 years ago, that's quite some time ago, while you were working on other projects, you said you saw babies dying. Is that right?
That's correct. The military team, actually, again, as training officer, I would provide the team with advanced training targets. Actually, I was slipping in an enigma. I did not want my team to fall into an ennui, to become bored with just working military research institutes and facilities. And I wanted to make sure that they had a wide variety of targets, so I would slip targets like this under their noses.
Same way they got Art's parts.
The same way, yes, essentially that kind of thing.
Yes.
And we were picking up, we were looking into the future, and we were looking at certain things and in ways that we do. I don't want to get into all the technologies tonight, but the team was describing and sketching dying babies over wide areas. And we traced back the source of the dying babies, and they were cow's milk. Cow's milk was killing dying babies. And in later years, actually about 4 years ago, I had SciTech take a look at the the cause, the causal agent behind that. And it appears to be a virus in the milk. We think it's a bovine AIDS. We're not positive about that, but we think that it is. Something like a bovine AIDS that's transmitted by dairymen's needles, the same needle that's used to inject each cow.
An immune problem of some kind.
With the babies, yes. We think that their planet's immunosuppressed, babies are immunosuppressed, their mothers are immunosuppressed, and now all of a sudden they are toxicologically insulted with a virus that's similar to AIDS and just wreaks havoc with this nascent immune system of theirs. And we do see human babies dying in droves.
Droves. Worldwide.
Worldwide, yes.
Any
country that where babies drink cow's milk, and that's a lot of countries.
That's a lot of countries. Do you? I guess I've got to ask. Do you come up with numbers? Is there any way to know percentages or?
We can't come up with numbers. We can come up with pie chart types of percentages. Alphanumerics and numerics are beyond our capabilities, but we can get rough figures. And we haven't done that in this case with any country in this specific case.
A lot. So many.
Yes, many.
Are you able to look then beyond that to see if that is alleviated or the situation worsens or how society deals with this?
We have not looked at anything that we have not looked at the situation beyond that. I do not know if there are any ameliorating factors or mitigating factors vis-a-vis that particular problem. So I don't have that information.
How far off is it?
Oh, it looks like it's within the next several years. We're coming up real close. One of the things that SciTech is doing now is establishing milestones along a timeline so that when one event occurs, people will know what the next one is and the time between them so that they can prepare. Prepare meaning take your babies off of cow's milk, start digging under the ground because heavy winds are coming, move from one area to another because you'll have no fresh water, those kinds of things.
I guess you can look right to the future and left to the past. Is it possible? The past, of course, is known. It's a known quantity. So I would think that as you look into the past with your trainees, with your residents, you can calibrate what you do to the left, can't you?
We can get distances and, we can get distances in time for unknowns, for instance. If you give me something and you don't know what time it was fabricated, what era or age, we can establish that.
What I'm referring to, though, is, and we're at the bottom of the hour here, there are known events in time, in the thread of time. As you look back, you can calibrate what you see.
That's correct.
That's what I wanted to know.
We
all right.
Can bracket the event.
Exactly. Major, stay right there. We'll be right back to you. Major Ed Dames, SciTech's Ed Dames is with me. He'll be right back. Look to the left. You can calibrate with history, and then let us now again look to the right. Again, hearkening back to what ABC ran about the farm belt, scared the hell out of me. Then I've got an Omaha Daily Herald story here that says a longer look at plains climate suggests an unsettling possibility, and they go into exactly the same thing here. Now, one of the things you said to me in the facts you sent that got us going in the last show was that the jet stream is going to come down on deck. And the jet stream, of course, wriggles and writhes all over the place, but you say it's going to come down on deck and there will be winds of between, 150 and 300 miles an hour on land?
Well, watch the jet stream. It's a really good indicator for how chaotic the atmosphere is going to quickly become. And it may not come all the way down to the deck, but it'll come close enough to furnish us with some very heavy-duty microbursts and some vicious storms. High, very serious winds. You'll need to be underground or in very solid structures when this happens. But moreover, the skies will become very dark over the mid-latitudes where these winds are high. And that's going to preclude growing crops the way we do now. There'll be no light.
That's what got to me about what ABC said. I mean, we're already on the way. We have crops in serious trouble. Our wheat crop in the country now is in very serious trouble. Cattle are being sold off, pennies on the dollar. It's horrible, and this is, I guess, just the beginning?
It's just the beginning, yeah. We've essentially damaged the Earth's stratosphere, the Earth's atmosphere beyond repair. There is not just a big ozone hole. What scientists generally are not aware of is that there's a deterioration of the upper levels of the troposphere the upper levels of the Earth's atmosphere now in a fashion very similar to metastasis, to cancer that's eating away at the upper levels of the atmosphere. There aren't any remedial actions that are good enough at this juncture. It's going to happen, so that's why it's so grim.
How soon?
Now, we're looking at the high winds beginning in about 4.5 to 6 years. As I mentioned last time we spoke, it'll take me, so I think, about another year to complete our study. And weather changes already are beginning, as you know. A year ago they started. We're going to see bacteriological changes here quickly.
Oh, you know what's interesting? You should mention that, because another news story that popped up a couple of days ago on Reuters was our government has suddenly cut loose with about $250 million, $250 million, to establish 12 early warning centers for new disease around the world, Major. There's $250 million, serious amount of money, to disease, and they're going to be looking for new stuff popping up. And I said at the time, these guys have got to know something we don't.
Well, I worked with those guys, and most of them are virologists. Unfortunately, viruses get most of the money these days. But there are other things, other changes. Bacteria, people, there's a lot of species of bacteria. They mutate a little bit faster than viruses. And we are not going to be, we as civilized industrial nations are not going to be able to keep up with the kinds of epidemics and pandemics that spring up. We're not going to be able to produce vaccines fast enough. They're going to outrun our ability to research them and chase them with vaccines. So we're looking at epidemics and pandemics, too.
Have we overused antibiotics? Is that the problem, or is there another profound change that's coming, even beyond that problem?
As far as we know in the company, it appears that it's an environmental problem, that the environment has so stressed the organisms, the bacteria, that they're subject to greater numbers of mutations. Ozone alone, for instance, I mean, ionizing radiation, when it hits us, may produce skin cancer, melanoma, but a ionizing radiation, when it hits a single-celled animal, that's metastasis at best, and a lot of mutations, much more than has been the case in the last few millennia.
So you're saying that what is occurring to our upper stratosphere atmosphere is like a cancer that, once begun, is going to eat everything alive before it's done?
Yeah, no, what I'm saying is that I just use that as an analogy. There's many holes. The atmosphere is deteriorating. There are lots of holes that will begin to appear, small ones, letting not just one large ozone hole over the poles. And that has gone unnoticed so far.
Well, I know that they've documented thinning of ozone across North America, for example, somewhere between, I'm trying to remember now, 3% and 7%, something like that, that will account for X number more skin cancer and so forth and so on. Really quite serious. But you're talking about additional actual holes.
Yes, I'm talking about a lot of scattered shotgun quilt work, patchwork type of holes in the ozone layer. I'm not certain that everybody realizes how serious this is. Life could not have begun on Earth until that ozone layer was in place. Every time amino acids came together to bond, bam, they were hit by, without the ozone layer to protect them, broken up. So that had to be in place before life could begin, and it needs to be in place if life is to continue. We're not going to evolve as a race, maybe we're not meant to, unless we survive.
Are we going to be able to continue to live above ground, or are we going to... Life.
Above ground structures will have to be made. This is why research like Biosphere 2 is important, and those kinds of hermetically sealed units. We need, first and foremost, some type of a habitat to grow crops in, a very large habitat. My company has actually sketched these kinds of habitats that we use to grow crops. These crops will be protected by high winds and will have enough light so that food can be produced by humans. And eventually, these habitats for plants will become templates for cities, similar to Biosphere 2. It's important that we start these kinds of projects now so that the technologies can mature, so that we work the bugs out by the time we really need to migrate into these. Below-ground structures and above-ground structures, they're going to be necessary.
But let's talk about numbers. I can understand you could do such a thing, grow crops even under those conditions, harsh as they would be.
Mm-hmm.
But numbers, Major, you even under the best of conditions with a crash program, right now America feeds itself and a good part of the world.
Until this year, huh?
Yeah, without our farm belt, Major, and with what you envision, the numbers of people that could be fed would be astonishingly smaller at best.
That's right. I used to be called Dr. Doom at the White House for other reasons, and I don't want to perpetrate necessarily that appellation, so I'm not going to get into numbers right now. I mean, I am saying that there'll be despeciation at rapid rates.
Yeah, I can read between the lines very easily.
Mm-hmm.
You think that it's in some ways better off that people don't know all of or how the scale of this?
I think it's difficult for the everyday person now enough. Without me prophesying, if you will, the kind of numbers that we see in health.
All right. Here's something from our last interview. After you had said most of what you've said now, not all of what we just heard, I said, well, what about you? There you are in... Where are you? You're in
Beverly Hills, California.
Beverly Hills, of all places. And I said, so what are you going to do personally? And you said, well, I'm moving west and south. And I said, to an island? And you said, something like that. And this was, and I said, well, gee, west, you know, in the water. Not identifying specifically where your company was going to go, but when you gave other people advice, you told them, go north. And so it hit me later, you're telling the population to go north, but you're saying, we're going south and west. Could you clarify that for us? Or?
There's actually a number of different places we've looked at that are sanctuaries. I happen to be heading toward some islands, yes. But we know that Switzerland, the Swiss Alps, and that area is also a sanctuary. And I'll give you the reasons why.
All right.
Very high mountains and very deep canyons protect against hard winds.
That's true.
Okay. They also have snowpack and glaciers, which provide a good source of water. Unknown quantity, and water is going to be a real problem. So, and then the other reason is those climates are cold, generally speaking, cold enough so that these bacteria remain fairly dormant in those environments, because I am telling you that bacteriological mutations are going to be a real big problem. It's nature carrying out bacteriological warfare against us, like Mother Nature or the Earth administering antibiotics to itself, antibio, and we may be the disease in this case.
Yeah, it's very close to what the Native Americans believe, that Earth is almost a living entity, and that we have insulted Earth and continue to insult Earth, and in fact you're saying we have insulted Earth to the degree that it's too late.
I think, yes, that's correct. I remember once, years ago, I found a pelican on the beach with it sitting very still, and a brown pelican. And I picked it up, and it bit me a few times. I put it in the trunk of my car. I felt really bad for it because it was covered with ants, small ants.
Uh-huh.
And I took it to a vet, and the vet called me up and said, hey, we dusted the pelican with, it was just with a powder, an antibiotic powder, and it's fine now. It was just sick. And all of a sudden, I realized that it knew to land and have those ants eat these lice that were attacking it, these mites that were attacking the bird.
Yes.
If it stood very still, the ants would naturally pick off the lice and eat them, and the pelican could fly away. So I actually prevented the pelican from continuing this process. And it reminded me of the situation, the state of affairs vis-a-vis Gaia or Solaris, whatever you want to call Mother Earth.
Well, I've had a number of Native Americans on this show and on Dreamland, and chillingly, they have predicted big winds. I'm sure you've heard some of that, but I wonder, have you consulted with Native Americans? Have you traded any information with them, or are you...
No, never. We really rely on our own methods for this, and years ago, we were picking up winds. It took us a long time, by process of elimination and direct knowledge, because that's what remote viewing is, to ascertain where these winds were coming from. I mean, we ran the gamut of, gee, is this nuclear war? Is it volcanic activity? Is there a pole shift? On and on and on. We could not find the answer until we popped up in the upper levels of the atmosphere and said, uh-oh, there's no atmosphere, or it's chaos up here. So we had to check and double-check our work. Otherwise, I would not be telling you on the air.
Yes. Well, I would think that governments, the governments of the world, particularly in view of your track record and your history, would be more than a little interested in what you're saying tonight. Have you had any contact?
A little. But it's going to be, we're ahead of our time. This kind of technology is just out of the closet. It's young. It'll be on the streets as soon as we can get it on the streets with as many young people as possible. That's our target group, particularly high school kids and individuals in their 20s. Our generation, we think, is a lost cause. Not totally, but we're staid and stoic, Art. I'm your age, or thereabouts, and we don't, old habits die hard.
They do. Yes, they do.